Slippery, when wet, classic fairy tales of murder and mayhem by Linda Fenneck. Acknowledgements. Many thanks to granddaughter Amanda Archer and friend author Rebecca J. Martin for their contributions to the cover art. This work was inspired by our love of writing many horror, murder and conspiracy songs such as I Can't Sleep at Night, The Henchman's Coming Random, Adduction and Criminal Tales Blues, which will be found on all major streaming sites under the band, our band name, Slippery When Wet. Linda Van Sydow, Kant Von Shadow. Rapunzel. Once upon a time, Abigail gasped,
"Oh, all these dreary places. It must be absolutely worse yet. A ladder instead of stairs. Can hardly catch my breath. Just walking.
You know, we go where the work is," Amber said.
"Well, that is all. I ever hear, Amber. You're always oblivious to that what kind of hovel we live in."
"You think this is what I want, Abigail? I suppose you'd rather not eat."
"Yes, forgive me, dear. Living over a barn is so delightful. I shall be soon craving hay if we stay here any much longer. At least it's not
sleeping in the forest dunning on snake.
I wonder what that rich lady in the big house is eating tonight. Better than the slop we are living on, I'm sure."
Wasn't it you just moaning about being fat, Abigail?
"Baby fat, like the heifer ready to drop. Maybe I am in the right place, come to think of it."
"You know the barn is not being used for animals anymore. I think you ought to be shut up for now."
"Well, it still smells to me.
It's not you in this condition running up and down for everything.
I can't even cook inside of this tinder box."
He ignored her, instead mumbled something about her needing his dinner. How hungry he would be, Abigail wondered. If he knew lately, she felt like feeding him poison for dinner. She turned around, taking in the tiny living quarters, really nothing more than a wooden box in a loft. She moved to the only filthy little window in the room and forced it open, and gazed out. Was she dreaming? Perhaps it was a bearable. Here, after all, the window looked down on the most beautiful sea of poppies now blooming behind a high wall. A breeze kicked up at the moment as if to tease her, infusing the air in sweet perfume. She watched, mesmerized, as the petals fluttered away, exposing plump, milky pods, perfect and ripe, a ready harvest.
"Amber? Huh?"
she called, a voice growing soft and breathy.
"Come over here, look at this."
"What now?"
Just get over here. I can't believe I didn't notice before."
"Darn it, I can't get anything to eat. Can I at least get some rest?"
"Stop being so obstinate and keep your voice down. Most everybody know your business."
Okay. He grunted out of his chair and lumbered to the window. "What is the commotion all about?" he said, asked, following a glaze. "Oh no, you're not having any of that. You gave it up."
"I'm going to have this baby one day now. I just need something for the pain."
"You know that's impossible anyway. We have no money, Abigail."
"Who said anything about buying them?" she hissed. "I don't care how you get some. Just get them."
There's no point arguing when she got this way, which is now much too often. He wanted any peace, he'll have to go do her bidding. Shaking his head and sighing, clambered down the ladder into the first floor storage area. Dusty and long search, but he discovered a piece of old meat hooks and a long coil of horsehair rope. It would work, sweating in the barn, waiting for the dark. He almost lost his nerve. He didn't want to be caught stealing from the powerful enchantress, Dame Ruffle, but he could not return empty-handed either, or Abigail would do something foolish like trying to get them herself, and she would surely get caught. He felt like a thief in the night. No, he was a thief in the night, he realised. A fallen shrubbery ringing the wall, clawed his flesh as if punishing him for his coming misdeed.
It was a new moon and the landscape was black velvet, but even in the dark he knew he was staring at what was at least a 10-foot wall. Unfurling the rope, Annabelle tried his first shot, a tossing hook over the wall. He blindly scrambled out of the way in the dark as the hook came crashing down again. He wasn't fast enough and bit his tongue, suppressing a scream as shot hook and grazed the side of his head. Annabelle cursed under his breath, wishing he could go back home, but a picture of raging Abigail flashing in his head kept him at it until finally he had a bit of luck. At last, without putting out an eye, he scrambled over the wall and staggered a paw full of blooms, heart pounding. A flood of adrenaline drove him quickly back over the wall, soaking wet and shaking, the thoughts about the heavy consequences of a thief. Amber fled, forgetting the hook on the top of the wall. By the time he reached the loft, he was exhausted and thrust the flowers into Abigail's face.
"Do you own your evil deed, woman? I need to get some sleep for work." "Oh, no, you don't. Not so fast. What the devil's this? I can't make anything out of this. You need to go back and get at least twice this. And you wonder who, and more that would be better."
"You're crazy. That woman's in the trenches. I'm not going back over there. Look at me. I'm a mess and bleeding. I'm smelling like a goat from pouring sweat."
"Big man crying like a baby over a few scratches. You're going back over there. And you're going to get more now. And don't come back until you do so," she hissed.
Amberna was still dazed from the recent blow. He gently probed a growing knot on the side of his head. His hand came away red. He wiped it on the tunic. "Okay, I'm going," he mumbled, and sat back out once again, fighting unruly hedges. He hoisted himself over the wall for the second time, but that was feeling weak and lost his grip. He somehow tumbled backward into the ground, with a resounding thud and water of the air escaping his lungs. His fall didn't do his head wound well enough. He lay still, listening, while trying to recover his strength from grasping like a fish out of water. Now his shoulder didn't feel right either. As he lay there again, trying to grow his senses and praying not to get caught, he listened closely for anyone else moving about. Only sympathy of crickets played to the flowers. His head cleared at last. He rolled over and began to belly crawl back through the back pitch black till he reached the closest patch of flowers. This time he did not timidly pluck a few stems, vault back to the wall. Instead, he violently yanked them out of the ground as fast as possible and stuffed them into pockets and any other places he thought he could carry some. Disoriented, he just stood and stumbled back to the wall. "Oh no, where's the rope? Had the crickets gotten quiet?" Now all he heard was his heart slamming in his chest. He frankly groped around the wall, both left and right, and then suddenly his hair stood on end, like it was electrical charge in the air. He abruptly froze in his tracks. A throaty female laughter floated eerily all around him. It sounded neither friendly nor amused. He threw down the poppies and once again, to no avail, began to frankly scurry back and forth, searching for the rope. From nowhere, a powerful hand shot out a clamped his wrist. A bolt of lightning flashed. He found himself gazing at who had only been the enchantress herself. He had not met her when he had been hired. She stood statuesque and stunning. Gleaming pattern of hair fell to her wrist. Thick waves it adulterated in the breeze against almost memorizing him. He could not guess her age. She would have been 20, or she could have been 200. She scared the life out of him. She gazed at the sky and softly murmured,
"Looks like the rainy season's coming."
His knees shook as he remained in a vice gripe.
We can use some rain," she continued.
The enchantress turned her head, her eyes on him. They glowed like a cat in the dark. He stuttered. "I was only getting some of your beautiful poppies for my dear frail bride. Please have mercy."
"Don't you mean your pregnant, addicted tart of a wife?"
If you don't get her some of those, she'll die
Foolish man, you believe that? It makes you a chance to steal from me.
No, she's just my wife.
Do you know what they do to fees her brother?
She coolly said.
They hang them.
Oh, please, please, he sobbed. I beg you.
I'll give you work, food and shelter. This is how you pay me. I should have taken a pass on you as soon as I laid eyes on your wife. And yes, I see you too through.
You did not know it. She's a bad one. And that poor child you two are bringing into the world,
this world,
she can only take care of yourselves. And speaking of the child, are you sure it's yours?
What could I do?
Edward's voice quivered. He was terrified of the idea of swinging in the rope. He would promise anything to avoid Dane Groff's wolf.
This is one of the most small things you can grant me, Edward in turn.
You shall have all the puppies you can carry. I will supply you a lovely big basket to carry them all.
Anything, please. Just please, he grovelled.
Are you certain, Admiral? It only turning back the price shall be tremendous if you cross me.
His wrists grew hotter in her grip. His near a blazing fire. Was it turning off his heat? A river of sweat flowed down the cliff of his back.
I want the child, she said. If it's a girl, you know.
Had he heard her wrong?
What do you mean?
When a child becomes, it belongs to me, she gripped, tightened painfully. His arm, his voice rose when she spoke.
You want the child?
And it then dawned on him. It was his chance to escape. Rich woman would care for the child. Abigail would look out for herself. A fanny with a drugged tart of a wife. And likely a bastard child was not all he wanted. Perhaps, indeed, it was not his. Even if it stung when the entrance said it, she made him face the truth. Already he was only making plans in his head to leave. Perhaps later, when Abigail passed out in a poppy stupor, he would gather up his things and sneak away. Dane Groffel was right. He was a fool. Let Abigail deal with her when the time came. She probably wasn't capable of taking care of it. Anyway, yes, Abigail whispered. Yes, he said again. A more convincing, yes. You may indeed have it. His wrists still in a death grip. She ranked him forward nearly, knocking him off his feet. He yelped at a sudden sharp pain. She had sliced his finger and jammed it against a piece of staff stiff parchment. She had no idea how she produced so fast or out of nowhere.
Damn, she said. I never forget what I said. Do you even think of running off with a child? As long as I have your blood, I will always track you.
She quickly dropped his wrist, rolled up the parchment, and she was gone like a puff of smoke. Abigail quickly felt the change in the air. He tried to rub some circulation back in his arm. The crickets now resumed chirping. A breeze whipped up, and he heard a gentle but unmistakable slap of rope swinging against the wall. He stood for a moment, rubbing his wrist and regaining what remained of his senses. He took a few cautious steps forward and stumbled right over the basket. She had promised a heavy rope was already attached to the sturdy handle so he could haul it up when he was ready to go. Now he was free to wander further in the garden. The ground was so thick with poppies, it was easy to grab handfuls and basket. Filled quickly, a storm was trying to move in, and forks of lightning in the horizon helped it guide his way. He grinned himself. Soon there would be no more demanding Abigail, no future screaming rat to put up with. He would be free. Abigail was huffed back to the barn and dropped the basket out in front in the dirt.
Abigail, he hollered up towards the window. Here's your darn flowers.
No response. Typical, we thought. Where was she? He walked around the back of the barn. There was a stroke in the fire. There was really rigged a pot over it.
Oh, you're back at last.
She taunted Abigail, haunting himself.
Why so long? You're fortunate. I returned at all. She caught me. Did you get them or not? I'm losing patience. Are you? It's a possible satisfy. Yes, I got them. Then why not stop blubbering and bring them over here to me? Abigail retorted.
He fetched a basket for her. As much as he hated what she was doing, his custody was got the better of him. He watched her suddenly nimble-fingered wife, whom normally could barely fix a decent egg for him. Like a master cook, she tovered over a steaming pot that reeked of lime and barred yard ammonia.
In the firelight, he could see that as Ermagil gently split open some milky pod and held them up one by one, letting their sap ooze into the boiling concoction. But soon a white scum began foaming at the top of the kettle of water, and she carefully scooped it off. He had seen enough, as he was much too tired to talk. Even his hunger was subsided. It didn't matter anymore to anyone. He decided to wait till he earned his first pay and he'd be gone. "I'm going to bed now," he said. Abigail didn't even look up for her task, or nor bid him good night. After another long day's work, Abigail was grateful for finally collapsing in the chair. "Abigail, what are you up there? I need something to eat." Silence. The sleeping curtain around his palate fluttered in the corner of his eye. He snapped his head that way. He rose, walked over, and thrust aside. Abigail gazed up from the sleeping pallet, eyes out of focus. He raised her head slightly. He wobbled his hands gently, her neck, before putting it back down and closing her eyes again. Suddenly, Edward was no longer worried about missing dinner. He could always eat later. He'd gotten paid, with Emma's current condition, he wouldn't have to wait all night for her to pass out. He immediately hurried to the meagre larder inside to pack himself a lion's share of food, along with other things. He's going to have to spend the night in the forest tonight without her. He'd be able to move more quicker, even more permanent shelter far quicker. He doubted the enchantress would let Abigail go hungry. No, not with the baby coming. No worries. Abigail would have the baby here. Dame Gothel would claim it. As for him, he'd be long gone. Abigail's flowers of joy were finally wearing off. She woke up to fussing that was lightly Abigail was fumbling around in the dark. Why didn't he light the lantern? Was he up? What was he up to? She had never trusted him. He always was able to get a job, and she needed that, especially right now. She heard him going down the ladder. Where was he going? She decided to follow. She descended on the lower level and called, "Emmanuel, are you down there?" And the doors was ajar. She stepped out in the night. Fingers of lightning shot across the sky. The back lit Emmanuel's back bulk, hurrying away. In a gathering dark, it appeared to be a bundle of his belongings. She didn't know what gave him so much strength as late as her pregnancy. Perhaps the great haze of anger quickly overcoming her as his cavalier desertion. Sprinting, lowered one shoulder, launching herself with a dead weight centre into Elverdale's back, sending him face first into stone wall of curling sack. He began scattering around him. His ankle and his nose snapped simultaneously. He tried to make a step and screamed in agony. A bitch had hobbled him. His nose leaked blood and he dizzily sank to the ground. The sky flashed again and the Admiral spied a metal meat hook on the ground, winking up at her. "Take me," he spoke to her in a poppy little brain. She obeyed, grasping it with both hands. The sky continued to strobe. Lightning held way and again charged. Abigail, now with his back to her, sitting on the ground, massaging his ankle. She covered a short distance. She swung the hook in the air with both hands and brought it down firmly into his skull. She viciously yanked it back, ripping a huge piece of bone, along with it being a torrent of red and grey matter pouring out of his head. He flopped over into one side into the dirt. Abigail's unnatural burst of energy now deserted her. Sudden pain tore to her inside, doubling her over. Water gushed from between her thighs. "Oh no, not now," she screamed, and she slipped out of her own mess and filling her face into Abigail's, going between more screams. She attempted to roll away. The storm was coming up and manic lightning bolts shot all across the sky. The earth itself now rumbled violently beneath Abigail as huge drops of rain assaulted her. When the entrancers materialized in Abigail's water-blurred vision, silhouetted against the light snow.
"I see my child is coming,"
the enchantress said, towering over her. Even while in pain, Abigail was stunned by the declaration.
"What do you mean, your child?" "I figured since you've just murdered your husband, you didn't
who didn't approve of our arrangement. Abel grasped another sharp pain racked to the body. Oh no, he wasn't deserting me. And then just one last crash and ripped Abigail apart, hemorrhaging her. So she lost all consciousness. The entrance bent down to scoop out the newborn, while Abigail's life leaped away in the rain, along with her husband, Abigail's. She glanced at the bodies, compost for the fields, she thought, returning to her task. She clamped the umbilical cord between her teeth, neatly severing it. Lightning continued to flash wildly, and heavens now continually opened, almost as if on cue. Dane Goff stood and raised the newborn to the downpour, and it washed the infant clean. She declared, "I see, I shall call you Rapunzel." She approached an adolescence faster than an actress could ever wish for. Rapunzel had her monthly a short while back, and the farmhands were already sniffing around like dogs. It would be no use to replace them. They all be the same when they saw her. Sea green eyes and abundance of pale pearl blonde hair, an hourglass figure was unmistakable magnet for the young men. And trances had made her reign in her comely hair, waving into thick braids and pulling under her kerchief, hoping to at least deter the young male lust. Rapunzel soon discovered she could hide things in those thick coils that had continued to grow like weeds, now several times the length of her body already. Her love's one lonely spring morning, a young field hand named Peter spied her sitting on the garden, stunning herself. He came up to her and said, You can make something magical with that. It will make you feel like a princess. He thrust a fat banquet at her, and he gathered as he spoke. But you must hide these from Dame Guffrell. Meet me here after dark, and I'll teach you, you know. As it sounded so exciting to her, she definitely bored at the time, and the only girl she ever saw, even close to her age, was a little one called Red, who stopped from time to time to get flowers from her grandmother. She would never stay and visit with Rapunzel for more than a hello and a few polite words. Later that afternoon, the flowers still carefully tucked under her ropes, a braid, she met up with Peter. He sneaked away to Long Lead, too, in a heavy thicket of the forest where she stayed. He built a small fire and an old stove and taught her how to turn the pods into magic. He promised as well as he taught her other things she did not know about. She liked it so well. The next day she invited him to the empty apartment for the old above this old storage barn to join her in the padlet behind the curtain and still hung there. It was taking a chance, but there were no insects to crawl over it in the loft like those invading his snack shack, and it gave her a bit of a much-needed thrill to think she could do it right under the Dane Gross nose. The enchantress was busy in town the day anyway, and Rapunzel knew she would likely be gone till sundown. Dame Gruffel left at the usual time, but a rock slide happened to block the enchantress's route apart. Way in a trip. It was an impossible narrow area, the path to simply steer the carriage round. So you have to turn to the farm, have to mend to get back to remove it. As the carriage pulled through the gate, her sharp senses kicked in high gear. Something was definitely amiss. She barely was out of the carriage when she heard faint laughter wafting towards her. It came from our barn, she was sure of it. Her interest dreaded what she must do. She did not hesitate and set off a brisk pace, standing beneath the loft, more muffled gurgles adrift. Drifted through the above, a mistaken odour premeditated in the dormant barn. Dame Gruffel had the ability to move in total silence and made use of it now. She reached the curtain and yanked it aside, and witnessed to her worst fear. Peter made a move to flee, and enchantress instantly placed. But both he and Rapunzel had a chance.
It's all over, Rapunzel, she said. Since you enjoyed it so well up here, you'll never leave. You'll have sealed your young man's fate as well.
Workers were summoned to the barn and quickly began double reinforcing the apartment walls at Dame Gruffle's orders. The men jumped at her commands like terrified rabbits and could not believe Peter was so foolishly bold. They had little trouble realizing Peter's fate while the blood-curdling screams drifting from the crowing house. Even all the hammering and pounding wasn't enough to block out all the horrible sounds. As the men watched, the enchantress again entered the loft and sadly shook her head as she spoke.
I've had such high hopes for you, she told Rapunzel,
though the girl could not yet respond.
But you gave me no choice but to board up the loft and keep you in it for your own safety. I should have known better than to take on a child of such peasant stock.
She turned and walked away out of the apartment, closing the only exit door behind her. Then she snapped her fingers at one of the men, ordering him to permanently board it up as well. Sundown approached. A few orange rays leaked from the single small wall window as Peter's screams finally ceased, and Rapunzel's trance was beginning to wear off. Morning dawned, and enchantress went to check on Rapunzel. She stood on the window, slowly chanting,
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let your hair down. Rapunzel appeared in the window and spat. Go away. I'll never wish to see you again. Have it your way, then, but you'll get hungry. You will not be so obstinate.
Perhaps I will return later, if in the mood, and see if your disposition has improved. Rapunzel placed the small dwelling, searching her way out, but there would be no escape. The only exit was well sealed. A one window was at least 30 foot above the ground. She had little more than a pitcher of water, basin, chamber pot. It would need a prison. By now, she's almost having murderous thoughts about him and Charles. She also knew that a woman could simply throw her into a trance, and she was helpless against her. Helpless against her, but for the term of a young life, she experienced rage, and she was getting hungry. It only made her angrier. It was almost sundown. Again, the enchantress showed up.
Hey, Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let your hair down. Why must I do such an odd thing?
Because I'm going to use it to climb up.
You will break my neck if you do that.
If you wrap it around the window frame, hawks first. And by now, Rapunzel was starving and saw the basket round Dame Gruffle's arm. At last, her long, thick rays tumbled from the window, and then this became Rapunzel's day-to-day existence. Dame Gruffle brought the food and water, and chambermaid would wait until she lowered her discards. On the day she finally decided she was losing her mind, she heard the pounding boots approaching. She dashed to the window, leaned out to see a well-dressed young man astride a fine steed. He definitely was not one of the farmhands mounted a carriage nag. Rapunzel waved and called to him, having no idea he was the king's young son. He was a bit of a rogue and enjoyed riding unannounced through other's properties. He especially liked imitating the locals when bald. He even got a thrill out of watching some of them fall on their knees before him. He halted his horse beneath the window, gazed at the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen.
Who are you and what are you doing up that window?
Who wishes to know?
Oh, saucy one, he fell instantly in lust. The other riches of the kingdom grovelled at his feet.
You're so droll.
Come here, he commanded. You still didn't answer my question, she retorted. He puffed.
He said, "Yes,
I am Prince, son of King Nefarious." Well, Prince, why not come down here? There, perhaps you can come up here. Well, why can't you come down as I command?
Had she not been so beautiful, he may have been angry, but he was not thinking with proper head.
This is my prison, she said. What do you mean, prison? An enchantress locked me up here. She's jealous because I am so beautiful. I wish to make me happy. In my prison is a bouquet of flowers of joy.
The prince was with a botanical challenge. Never heard of such a flower. But still, we prepared to enter the entire kingdom, search the entire kingdom, high and low.
But how shall I get them to you? Just do it, and when you shall find out,
Do not bring them before sundown, or the address will have me killed if he catches you.
The prince promised to return that eve. He had no idea the enchantress of the main supply of the kingdom that the girl, what the girl requested. He did not know if he grew the fields only yards away on the other side of the wall, or nor did she tell him Rapunzel. Nor would she tell him. Rapunzel did not want the enchantress to catch him and find out she had spoken to him, nor put him up to the task. She truly hints he would easily be able to find out for her. The prince spurned his horse back to the castle as fast as he could go and ordered his personal servants to scour the kingdom of flowers. The hours called as he waited for word. He paced his quarters, but as well at the last servant returned, clutching a hearty bouquet. At sunset he had fresh mounted, saddled, and rode off to the enchanted domain, busy pushing his horse to open run. He was not first to notice the steam of pedals in his wake, but there was nothing he could do now. He'd bring them away anyway to prove he'd made the effort. Surely he should consider the noble gesture. The horse snorted in protest, a too vigorous yank on the reins. A full moon glinted off a bundle of braids, giving away her position at the windows.
I'll come with your flowers.
He thrust the petalous bulbs towards her, exactly as she wanted.
What happened to the petals?
She teased. Even in approaching gloom, she could see his reddening face as he stammered.
I was riding so fast that...
Relax, Prince. I was only teasing.
Yeah, oh, beautiful, she said, coyly tossing down her braids in invitation.
Confusing Marcy's face.
I'm in silly. It's only
another of the evils she's done to me.
The room I'm sealed is the tight as a tomb. I feel I should never be free again.
Young and strong, he easily climbed the distance and pulled himself up to the steel. She begged him to unwind the braids from the sturdy hooks. He felt a bit foolish out of a handful of what was supposed to be flowers, but now looked more like pale little bald heads. Rapunzel was beaming at him. Uncoiling the last of her hair from the hooks, she pulled it all in, and then grabbed his hand, pulling him towards the curtain. He must have been close to dawn when he departed the room, but she told him when he returned to stand below the window and only chant,
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let your hair down. Let down your hair.
He made it back to stable just minutes before sunrise, pretending to be stable, and he couldn't sleep and went out early for a ride. He was not tired anyway. Elated and spent, already looked forward to being with her again. The prince was not able to slip away for several days. He did not want to repeat the embarrassment and gift of bald flowers, and hoped she could be happy to see him. It was after all the prince. Standing over under the window, he softly called out,
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let your hair down.
The prince listened for a moment and said,
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let your hair down.
Rapunzel finally appeared at the window, looking quite unlike her fresh, pretty self, eyes black as soot, underneath she was weaving in place. She looked like she might tumble out on the ground if not careful.
What is wrong with you? I'm coming up there, Rapunzel. Let me down your hair in this instant,
he said impatiently, but trying to keep his voice down.
What did you bring me? She stirred.
You know you have to let me up to find out. The prince was botanically challenged and never heard of such a flower, but he still prepared to search the entire kingdom high and low. How will I get them? But still, he's prepared to search the entire kingdom and get them.
But how shall I get them from you? Just do when you shall find out. Do bring them before sundown, or Chantess will kill me if she catches you.
Prince promised to return that eve. Yeah, I did, and Chantus was the main supplier of the kingdom that quite requested. He did not know that he grew in the fields only yards away on the other side of the wall, nor did he tell him. Did she tell him? Rapunzel did not want the Chantus to catch him and find out she had spoken to him, nor put him on a task. He truly is a prince. He should easily be able to find some for her. The prince spurned his back of the halls back to the castle, past he could go and ordered his personal servants to scour the kingdom for flowers. The hours called as he waited for the word. He paced his quarters, but at last one servant returned, clutching a hearty bouquet. As sunset cheered, a fresh mounted saddled, rode off the enchanter's domain. Busy pushing his horse into the overrun, he first noticed the steam battles in his wake, but nothing he could do now. It would bring them anyway to prove he made the effort. Surely she would consider the noble gesture. The horses snorted in protest at the too vigorous yank on the reins. A full moon glinted off where her hand was raised, giving away a position at the window.
I'll come here with your flowers.
I've come here with your flowers. He thrust the petals bells up towards exactly what she wanted.
Why aren't it the pebbles?
She teased. Even the approaching gloom, you could see his reddening face as she stammered.
Oh, well, I was wrong, Sir Falstead. Relax, Prince. I was only teasing. It's beautiful, she said cautiously, tossing down a brazen invitation.
Confusion marked his face.
God, I'm silly. It's just only another of the evil things she's done to me. I'm a room. I am sealed as tight as a tomb. I fear I shall never be free again.
Young and strong, he was easily climbed the distance and pulled himself over the steel. As he began to unwind a brow each on the sturdy hooks, he felt a bit foolish out of holding out a handful of what was supposed to be flowers, but now looked like pale little bald heads. But Hansel was beaming at him, recalling the last of the hair before the hooks. She pulled it in until pulled it all in, and then grabbed his hand, pulling him towards the curtain. It must have been close to dawn when he departed her room. She told him that when he returned to stand below the window and softly chant, Rapunzel, let your hair down.
Lay down your hair.
He made it back to the stable just minutes before the sunrise. He pretended to be his stable hand. He couldn't sleep and went out early for a ride. He got to the ride anyway. Elated and spent, he was already looking forward to being with her again. Prince was not able to slip away for several days. He didn't want to repeat an embarrassing gift of all flowers. I hoped she would just be happy to see him. He was after all the prince. Standing in the window, he softly called out,
Rapunzel, let your head out, let down your hair.
The prince listened for a moment, then more falsely,
Rapunzel, let your down your hair.
Rapunzel finally appeared at the window, looking quite unlike a fresh, beautiful, pretty sight, her eyes black, the soot underneath. She was wearing, even in place. She looked like she might have tumbled out on the ground, if not careful.
What is wrong with you? I'm coming up there, Rapunzel. Let down your hair this instant, he hissed, impatient, trying to keep his voice down. What did you bring me? She slurred. You have to let me up to find out.
She was indeed an obstinate one, he thought. She finally twined the braids around the hooks and tossed them to him. When he clambered over the steel, Rapunzel unwound the hair and drew it in. Her eyes were still a half mask.
Where are my flowers?
What's wrong with you? He said yet again.
I didn't bring any. The petals are all blown away while I rode.
Her bloodshot eyes glowed angrily.
You fool, I don't care about the flattles.
She didn't look so pretty anymore. She made him uncomfortable. She looked like a predatory cat.
I am the prince, and I've not stood here and be called a fool.
He turned around and leaned up to the windows, looking out.
I demand you throw out your hair so I can leave.
Snatching by the up the wayward garden hoe, she then began. Then she had been trying to use to hack her braids. She could hook them to the window. She and herself escaped. She screamed,
"Down you to hell!"
And changing at him, she jammed it nearly in the back of his neck.
And you will not leave till I say you do.
Prince could do no more than gurgle in response. She caught in a red haze of anger and disappointment. She wrapped one of the thick braids around his bloody throat and choked away whatever his life remained. The next morning, Grovel appeared. He runs with daily rations. To her surprise, found a grand horse sniffing him out. Hired Hand by Melissa Skoroda. An excerpt. You hire me? A what? Marlowe Smith asked behind the clenched teeth. Marlowe, Joey said, as if talking to a 5-year-old. It's a birthday present. You need to cut loose. You need a break. Marlowe stared at her best friend, an administrative assistant, wondering if she'd taken to drinking in the middle of the afternoon. Joey stood before her, a red spandex excuse of a dress in her hands, a calm look on her perfect face. Yep, she'd been hidden in the bottle. A break? A break does not include hiring a gigolo for the night. With an expressed high sigh, Joey tossed the dress on the bed. Listen, hun, you've been working like crazy the last few months. Problems with the company. Well, you need to get laid. Yeah, I know, but a gigolo? Joseph Venom. A gigolo? Listen, you haven't dated anyone since Vic. You need this, and Clarice owes me. Only Joey would have a childhood friend who became the owner of escort service. Marlowe didn't even want to contemplate what favour Clarice owed her. There's no way on earth this is going to happen, Joey. Marlowe, no, I'm not that type of woman. It needs. Joey placed a hand on her hip and raised an eyebrow. Okay, I'm not the type who wants a gigolo. Joey snorted, but kept her mouth shut. Now, how much time do we have? Joey's eyes widened. I thought you said you didn't want to go. I didn't want a gigolo, but if we're going to the club and hiring him, I can't see him sit there all night wondering what happened. Marlowe, no, we're going. I'm going to stand there while you explain. You're the one who hired him and didn't desire to avail myself to his services for the evening. He still couldn't believe Joey pulled this. When we were supposed to meet him, 10, it was supposed to be you, not both of us. Marlowe glanced at the watch. She had less than an hour. You'd never use the panic. Then he'd meet the man, tell him about what happened. I'll go in to take a quick shower. I feel funky. She grabbed her toiletry bag. Don't try anything when I'm gone. She fired for the shower 10 minutes later. The grime a 2-hour car drive trip after a long day at work washed away. Immediately, she realised her clothes were no longer sitting on the counter where she had placed them. She shrugged it off, thinking Joey must have grabbed them. Up. After hurriedly drying her hair, she wrapped the towel round her body and walked out the door, an empty bedroom. Joey? Silence. Joey? An uneasiness crept in her stomach, sewing the contents. Joey? Still nothing. She walked into the living room and worry increased when she found it empty as well. Thinking to get dressed as fast as possible, she dashed to the bedroom. Only his suitcase was no longer sitting in the luggage rack. Joey? She groaned. She paced the room, trailing her finger at the thumbnail. Joey was outrageous, unpredictable, unspoken, but Malone even thought if you leave her in a Dallas room, hotel room, nothing, anything to wear, thinking there might be something in the dresser. She ran to it and began opening drawers, but as she found each one empty, her panic increased, the pounding in her head became unbearable. Every bit of her clothing was gone, including her underwear. She couldn't believe Joey had done this. They had been best friends since the moment she hired Joey. Marlowe shook her head. Even with her over-the-top personality, Joey would never leave in Dallas without clothes. At least Marlowe didn't think she would. Marlowe wandered back in the living room and realised the closet door was ajar. She walked to it, hoping Joey had left her things in there. Her heart sank when she pulled it open and found only the red dress Joey had brought her, hanging there, draped over one shoulder with a pair of off black thigh highs and racy red push-up bra over the other. Resting on the floor was a pair of matching stiletto pumps. A piece of hotel stationery was stuffed on the top of the dress. She yanked it out of the dress, dread settling into her stomach. Marlowe, you'll kill me when you get back to Abilene. Mr. Jones will be at the club, wearing his green shirt, sitting at the bar. He's supposed to be over 6 feet, blonde with blue eyes. You don't do anything I wouldn't do. Milo waded up the piece of paper and threw it in the waste bucket. How could Joey do this to her? Marlo didn't need a break. She needed was a good administrative assistant. She looked at the dress and shook her head. It would barely cover her butt. But there's no way she's going to meet a hired escort dressed in that. She didn't care. She sat there all night. She didn't, really didn't. I'm sorry, Mr. Jones, but we have no idea. No, I have no idea for an escort tonight, Marlo said with a frown. No, this wouldn't sound right, but how did one fire a gigolo and not sound like an idiot? She hurried down the street to the club and signed when the neon sign came into view to block her head. A flashing red and white letters pierced the dark sky street, illuminating the entrance. With each step she took, the stiletto heels jarred her feet. She returned to her hotel room. Tonight she consigned the red torture devices to hell and soaked her feet for a month. She paid the doorman. Hurried to the nightclub, goosebumps exploded across her skin while she'd stepped from the sultry Texas heat into the cool air of the nightclub, a glaring reminder that her chest was almost as bare as her neck. She shivered and crossed her arms. She was ready to kill Joey when she could get hold of her. A red lancet sheath hung on her hips and rear end, highlighting every jiggle. With every step, the hem of it rose, and she hoped it wasn't rising above the top of the lacy thigh highs Joey had left for her. Milo mentally reminded herself of Joey's description of the man he eyed. That he's 6 foot tall, blonde hair, green eyes, and wearing a green shirt. She glanced around the room and was surprised that more than a couple of pairs of eyes stared back, expecting like a piece of meat from the stockyards, usually. Jane Smith did not attract attention, small boned and short. She lacked the feminine attributes most men thought was sexy. Well, at least the big commercials told them was sexy. Milo rubbed her arms and scrutinised the men while line dancing. Lots of good looking blondes. None of them were wearing a green shirt. Unwilling to able to abandon her search, she decided to make one trip around the club. Marlo would walk past a few of the tables, looking over the men, but not making eye contact. Aching her feet intensified with each step. Joey never had left these clothes, knowing Marlo would never let the man sit there all night. In rules of etiquette were so ingrained in her, she had to tell female hooker she didn't need his services for the evening. It was a compulsion to do exactly the right thing. Isn't so sad. She might have laughed at a foolish fault. She glanced around the club again, almost shrunk under the scrutiny. Ignore them. She could almost hear Joey whisper in her ear. Determined to make it through the crowd and find Mr. Jones, she threw her shoulders back, causing her chest to rise and raised her chin a notch. Then she saw him sitting on the lap at the end of the bar, with her head practically in his lap. Marlo glanced at the woman, gave her a dirty look, then cut a look to the man. Though he draped his arm around the back of the other woman's hair, he was staring at Marlo. She shivered as his gaze dropped down from his eyes, then to her shoulders and finding her breasts. He continued a frank assessment down to toes, then all the way back up. One corner of his mouth quirked, eyebrow was raised. Before she allowed herself to contemplate how to approach a paid escort, he leaned over and whispered something in the woman's ear. He smiled, and she shot Marlo another dirty look while flouncing away. Marlo glanced back at the man to find him gazing directly back at her, his intense stare causing a heated blush to rise from her chest to her face. Marlo walked slowly toward the end of the bar. She inhaled deeply and took a seat. Be short to the point. Mr. Jones, I think there's been some kind of mistake. Darling, he said, his voice as smooth as whiskey. You're drinking? I'm not Mr. Jones, although I have to say, his eyes travelled down her body again. I turned to her face. I didn't mind taking his place. His sensuous curves curved, and a couple dimples appeared. She wondered twice, gathering the courage to explain who she was. If she was about in a boardroom, in her own clothes, she wouldn't have a problem confronting this man. Joey wouldn't flirt. Marlo rarely used flirtation. She never understood the finer points. Uncomfortable in any kind of man to woman situation. My mother failed miserably during a last stint, a dating scene. Never the one to spend a Saturday night defeatless. Jay badgered Malone about finding a man, but Malone avoided the discussion. She wanted to find a nice man and wanted to settle down. Malone was looking for a great passion, a dependent man who wanted a quiet life with a wife and kids. A life was fine with her. Joey thought she was a crazy hence the sex school. As he sat there smiling at her with the blasted dimples and expectant look on his face. I know that's not your real name, she said, aware of his taxed action had grown more pronounced. But there's been a mistake. He leaned forward, placing his arms on the bar, confused, darkening his green eyes. I'm not the one who hired you, but I promise you you'll get paid. Hired me? He almost croaked. Yes, he said, lightly. Another glimpse of her eyes wandered to his open collar. A glimpse of golden brown hair curled in the V of his great green shirt. She found the urge to tell him to button it up. At the same time, she couldn't resist reaching out to comb her fingers for those curls and feel the hard, hot muscle in his chest beneath them. Why the hell was she fingering these muscles? Her friend thought that it would be a good idea to hire a man. Me for my 13th birthday. She watched the dimples disappear. Like I said, you'll get paid. I just can't see a good reason for buying a man, even if he's built like a great god. He realized he raised one thick blonde eyebrow. But at least let me buy you a drink. She searches his expression on his face. Over the perusal, he didn't show any more interest in her than he probably would have shown any other woman. He definitely wasn't overcome with lust. She said, sure, but then I already have to go. Lorraine Kermel stared at the P&AT woman beside him. She placed an order in the bar with the bartender. He felt free to look his fill when she ordered over the bar and ordered a club soda. She was little, small-boned, but she couldn't be more than 5 foot tall and stocking feet. When he first saw her walk for the club, he thought she was taller, but the killer fuck-me heels she wore gave the illusion of height. It really didn't matter. He loved all women, tall, short, skinny, fat, and any colour. He liked them. He didn't personally love as many as his brother, Heath, claimed he did, but he was never lost for date. He strict guideline when he ended up in his bed. Women he dated knew the score, a fun time, no strings attached. He'd been sitting on the end of the bar, waiting for Heath, thinking he'd stood up Liam at work once again. He was about to call night when he called Heath to gripe at him with a flash of red caught his eye. What struck him first was her demeanour. She carefully stepped through the crowd, avoiding contact with most of the people there. She walked across the floor like a Deb on the night of her coming out, but dressed like sin. The red dress she wore left little to her imagination. It clung to every curve she had. A mass of inky hair cascaded down her back, making her want to bury his face in it. He couldn't make out the colour of her eyes, but she looked at some shade between blue and grey. Surrounded by thick lashes, she wore little makeup, but her bee-stung lips were painted almost the same shade as red as her dress, and she had the cutest little overbite. At the moment, she was worrying her bottom lip when he realised he was staring at her mouth, wondering what it tasted like. He met a glaze and saw apparition. She must have strutted through the bar like a self-assured woman, but she was nervous. Well, who wouldn't be when trying to get to the paid escort to take a hike? Now, he said, leaving it hanging and waiting for her to answer. Smith, Jane Smith. He chuckled. Smith Jones. He sat up straighter, thrusting her chest out. My real name is Smith. And interesting, maybe Mrs. Smith was using another first name. Mrs. Smith, don't you explain why you don't need an escort for the evening? He knew he was attracted to the opposite sex and enjoyed it when a woman was bold enough to approach him, just as much as he enjoyed chasing them. But in all his years, he never had one of them trying to pick him up, claiming she paid for him for the evening. Not anyone else, not someone else had to pay. Storm Island. A Kate Pomeroy Mystery by award-winning author Linda Watkins. Late July 2017, South Storm Island, Maine. The flashing blue light on the top of the police cruiser cast eerie shadows on the stone walls of the old manor house. I watched as they danced about, blending occasionally the red and white ones from the ambulance. The result was a tabloid reminiscent of the 4th of July that recently came and gone. It's both beautiful and ironic. What happened tonight in that house could no way means ever be described as a celebration. A shiver ran down my spine. I wrapped my arms around myself to ward off the chill. I was standing in the shadows of the corpse of the trees, watching. The rain had started as a drizzle, was rapidly becoming a downpour. I pulled up my hood of my windbreaker as the heavy drops began to mingle with my tears. The old wooden door of Stormview Manor abruptly creaked open. I waited, knowing in my heart who or what might be coming out. EMTs pushing a gurney swiftly exit the moose. The hoods of their snickers obscuring their faces as they tried to stay dry. The gurney they propelled wasn't empty. A long, dark blue bag made of thick plastic sat on top. I suppressed a scream as I watched it bounce down the steps of its on its way to the ambulance. The tears that strained my cheeks intensified. I knew who was in that bag. I knew I'd never see him again. It broke my heart. As the first responders loaded the gurney into the rear of the ambulance, my attention was diverted back to the old manor house. The two men came through the old wooden door and hurried through down the steps. One was in uniform, and I recognised him. It was Officer Stubble, Storm Island's resident policeman. The other, wearing a beige overcoat, collar turned up to avoid a chill. A stormy night was, I believe, a detective, a stranger from the mainland, who would be charged with investigating the recent death. I watched the policeman as he conferred. The door opened again, and stepping into the porch were two other figures, whom I knew well, my aunt, Hepanesia, and her husband, Rolel. They stood on the top step, under overhang, sinking shelter from the rain. Rolel had his arm around her Hetty, holding her protectively as she leaned her hand into his chest. The man in his overcoat spoke briefly with them. Then the other officer in uniform emerged from the men's. He was carrying several plastic containers, bags that had, I assumed, held a murder weapon and other vital evidence. I know that as much as he wanted to stay, it's time to take my leave. Slowly, before carefully not being noticed, I turned and walked swiftly down the path that led to the Courage House, a place I called home that summer. Time was now of the essence. They would be needing me soon, and they would come. I needed to be ready. The Weekend Hunt, when tea building adventure for three policemen is going wrong. Mutant Hunt, Old School Clip Survival Adventure. Old Apocalypse Adventures Book 1 by Anthony Lee TV again. The trip. Cloudless sky is slightly coloured scarlet in the east when dark steep stops in front of the blow block. Sleepy soldiers yawn and don't hurry back to check documents. Slide window is lowered. The prosecutor's certificate is exposed in front of the guard's face. Immediately, barriers rise and Patriot leaves the city. Nothing is better than to spend a weekend with colleagues on the hunt, especially if today Lena planned a visit to her mother, next time to see her mother-in-law, but only in 3 months. Boko shot a grin and pressed the accelerator harder. What's so funny? Nearby prosecutor is grumbling. Sinuklevi covered his grey hair with a hood of a battle painting special suit. He still has a headache after yesterday's meeting. The bar beer was needlessly, especially if you needed, you started with whiskey and brandy. Wife tries to call him. She doesn't understand. He had to stay at work for night because of an important case. Well, at least in this, in the country, a connection is not available. Otherwise, phone battery would have already been discharged. Hey, trainee, give me a beer can. Gouvernier fumbles in the back seat, exploring grocery bags. Among the heaps of vodka bottles, he hardly finds a beer. Here, Kostanin Aglaezonov held on. Thin hand serves a cold can. 45 years old, Sinonorov leave. Had a pretty good job as a prosecutor of the most dangerous district called Dump. But he wanted to stay alive to retirement, so goes to gym and shooting gallery together with Detective Balunonegeye. He is younger than his chief for 15 years. He does not wear a police uniform. He would rather look like a bandit. Dark hair, low forehead, cool look, thin lips, and a neat beard. Why do we leave so fucking early? Mumbles to live and greedy drinks at Tazio. So, it's still about 2 hours drive. Hours drive, driver slows down. A car circling round the potholes on the pavement. Derby, Derby, Go to School, written by Susan Pennington. Illustrations by Mike Moose. Breakfast, mouse style. It was a beautiful August day. The sun was shining. A gentle breeze blew through the yard. The leaves and the trees and the flowers in the yard seemed to be waving good morning to Susie as she burst through the front door into the porch. She had some exciting news and eager to share it with her friends Toby and Dobie. Quickly she climbed into the big green wicker chair below the mouse house Aunt Olive hung up for them. Using her finger, she tapped on their front door. From inside, she could hear Dobie yell, "I got it, Mum." "Mother?" "Hey, Susie," Dobie said, opening the door. "It's a beautiful day, isn't it?" "Yes, it is," Susie agreed. "I invite you in, but you are too much. You're much too big," Dobie laughed. He liked teasing Susie about how big she was. Susie kibbled and gave Dobie a poke with his tummy. "Silly mouse." Mother Mouse, wondering whom her little one was talking to, came to the door. She wore the apron Aunt Olive had sewn for her and was wiping her paws on it. "Good morning, Susie," Mother Mouse said. "You up and about early? Are you cooking breakfast? Something sure smells good," Susie said, sniffing at the air. "Cheese omelettes and cheesy biscuits," Mother Mouse answered. "Would you like to try some?" "Yes, please," Susie said, a great big smile on her face. "Okay, I'll be right back," Mother Mouse said, turning towards the kitchen. Just then, Toby appeared at the door. "What's up?" he asked. "Your mum is getting me some of your biscuit breakfast for me to try. It smells delicious." "Your mum is getting some of your breakfast for me to try. It smells delicious," Susie told Toby. "Mother makes the best cheesy omelettes and cheesy biscuits for everyone. It says, see if I, Dobie, and I can bring ours outside too." "Be right back," Toby said, running towards the kitchen. "A picnic for breakfast," Toby said. "How cool was that?" "Pretty cool," Susie said. I'll go and pull out my picnic table for us. Susie jumped on a chair and ran. To the corner of the porch where Mummy kept her picnic table. It was pretty heavy. Susie tugged and tugged. Soon she had it out in the sunlight where he would enjoy their breakfast picnic together. Just as Susie got it placed, Toby and Mother Mouse came to the door carrying plates. Susie reached up and took the plates one at a time and Mother Mouse and placed them on the table. Then she took Toby's and put them on the table too. Mother went back and got three nibbles full of milk as Toby and Dobby scurried down to the table. When Mother Mouse returned, Susie took the nibbles out of her milk and placed them on the table next to the plates. You children enjoy your breakfast. Don't forget to put your dishes up here in the pouch before you run off to play, Mother Mouse instructed. We won't forget, the three friends echoed, settling down to enjoy their breakfast. There are the best cheesy biscuits I ever had, Susie said. Of course, I don't think I've ever had cheesy biscuits before. Probably not, Dobby said. Only mice eat cheese. Don't be silly. Humans eat cheese too, Toby said, shaking his head at his goofy little brother. They do, Dobby asked with surprise. Of course we do, Susie said. We eat lots of... The Stories of the Nice One. Poems, short stories and illustrations from the fictional novel The Nice One by Joshua Chiani Perry. Illustrated by Judah Claxton. The Nice One Project, Reality Redefined. The history of this world begins in the same players, but the world story has changed. In Genesis, Cain, envious of his brother's love, of his own, his Lord's love of his brother Abel, offering over his own, plants the seed of committing the first murder in mind. He spies Abel in the field, sharpening a medieval tool for shearing. Cain grabs a sharp harvesting tool and creeps upon Abel. Right as he's about to strike Abel down in a cold blood, he steps on a twig, snapping it in half. Surprised, Abel rolls around, accidentally driving the shearing tool right into Cain's heart. First murder is now an accident, and the repercussions directly change the course of humanity. The Nice One opens in the year 2000 in Brentford, Stratford Street section in Brooklyn, New York City. Bed-Stuy is a large and developed urban centre, the apex of developable explosion. Spectators, forecasters, have been making bids for the past several years to develop housing complexes and new businesses and rush to plant their roots in an area that had been neglected and nearly abandoned just a mere decade ago. Conflict has erupted all around the globe. Chris Sinderson is high and corrupt. His corruption is ramp, and such discontent has bred a response for the ARC. On its face, the ARC is a multi-ethical organization for cultural entities whose private investments hold many sway in the politics of the world. Their ethos, ignorance, it will bring chaos to the world, and only through order and discipline can humanity put itself back on. The best edible wild plants in Britain, easy to find and good to eat. Kindle edition by Amanda Scott. Some of the best edible wild plants can be found in Britain. Well, which ones are they? Amanda Scott does the hard work for us, gives us a list of those that are easy to find and good to eat. These plants can be found in the gardens throughout Britain. They are so-called weeds, and many people spend a lot of time and money trying to get rid of them. Foraging from your front garden, FF is a new buzzword these days. Amanda explains how we don't have to spend hours travelling to find wild food. It's right on the doorstep and been all the time. Just we haven't allowed wild food plants to grow because we class them as weeds, i.e. plants growing in the wrong place. However, they are not growing in the wrong place, they're growing in the right place. These plants are not only edible, they're good, they taste good, they're completely free. By allowing them to grow, we still stem the decline of wildlife in Britain. Most of us don't eat the wild plants readily for many reasons. We might think they don't taste good, or we don't need too much work trying to find them. They need not to be the case. Sting thistles, for example, make a wonderful cooked spinach. In fact, they say nettles taste better than spinach because it's not as slimy. Other plants don't have to be cooked at all. If you only experience a wild salad, a plate of dandelion leaves, it was a very bitter experience. You have to try chickweed. It's mild in flavour and can be used as a straight substitute for lettuce. This isn't about wallowing around in the mud, digging up roots, spending hours peeling, soaking and boiling all sorts of strange, muddy plant material, only to find it tastes disgusting. It's all about a few good bits of plants commonly found in Britain's gardens today. For those who don't have wild plants, there are ways of obtaining them, including waiting for them to come. They will, or growing them. Oh, go on, give it a go. You know, you want to. Highlander Imagine. For Lover's Sake, Wendy Lou Jones. He's coming for me, Duncan. Duncan threw his arms around Teresa, the woman he loved more than his own life. As by his own act, his false will alone, he could somehow halt the impending nightmare which was unfolding around them when an apparent drug-related shooting nearly takes Tressa Noel's mortal life. Duncan, which he searched for the shooter to bring him to justice. Immortal Amanda is on the prowl again. Her female instincts led them her back to the irresistible Duncan, complicating matters. Treasers unexpectedly confronted with a secret information she could have not foreseen coming, threatening to unravel the bond between her ugly, handsome, immortal Highlander. But it isn't Amanda's wanton desires Treasure has to worry about. When hostile immortals close in, Duncan, cantina in hand, perhaps to take heads in a fight to return their knowledge to normal. But can he detect the real threat in all the confusion around him before it's too late? Highlander Imagined is a series based on the original Highlander TV series. The book reboots the series just 5 seconds before the bullet hits Treza in a TV episode called The Darkness and asks the question, how would everyone's life change if Treza had survived? This work of series was fully authorised by Davis Panzer Productions and Studio Canal Films Limited. However, the content is wholly on an RK Books original creation, a new action series.